Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
This is Mike Volo, host of Slate's Lexicon Valley. After a long hiatus, we are back with an all-new episode Monday, July 14th, and every 2 weeks thereafter. We'll also be introducing a new feature with the great linguist and lexicographer Ben Zimmer. Join us Monday, July 14th, for an all-new episode.
The Gabfest is sponsored by Stamps.com. Buy and print official U.S. postage using your own computer and printer, and have your postal carrier pick up your packages. Sign up for a no-risk trial and get $55 in free postage when you visit Stamps.com and use the promo code GABFEST.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political GABFEST for July 11th, 2014, the May I Introduce You to President Harding and His Friend Jerry edition. I'm David Plotz, the editor of Slate. I'm in Washington, D.C. today on the GABFEST. The catastrophe in Israel, how much worse can it get? Then, what Democratic majority are millennials actually going to become conservatives? That's what the New York Times said this week. And then Warren Harding, that's a name we have not said much on the show. Warren Harding wrote saucy, extremely dirty letters to his mistress. Should we be shocked? Also, after that, there's going to be a Slate Plus segment, our bonus segment on the GABFEST for you who are Slate Plus members. And in it, I talked to a couple of Hollywood screenwriters about why Hollywood and the popular culture is so obsessed with Washington these days. It was a really good conversation. You can go to sign up for Slate Plus by going to slate.com/GABFEST+. Joining me today from New Haven is, of course, Emily Bazelon, Slate senior editor. Hello, Emily.
Hey, David.
You're the least Warren Harding-like person at Slate, I think.
Wow. What did I do to earn that accolade?
Like, you're just not, it doesn't seem like you're interested in Teapot Dome.
Oh,
you're not like a paunchy white guy.
I wouldn't name your penis Jerry. That's true.
You wouldn't name your penis Jerry. And then John Dickerson is on vacation, which left us with a little dilemma. When John Dickerson goes on vacation, what can you do? Fortunately, at our disposal, down the street at the Atlantic, where he is, the national correspondent, is Jeffrey Goldberg. When you want to talk about Israel, you pray that Jeffrey Goldberg will come.
I can talk about Warren Harding's penis as well.
You will be talking about that.
I will, and I will be.
Do you think he was circumcised?
He was not circumcised. I am 100% sure.
That is a really strong statement.
I'm a 95% sure that he wasn't circumcised.
We will definitely talk about whether he was circumcised. Jeff, welcome to the GABFEST.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you.
It's quite an honor to be sitting in for John Dickerson. I'm going to tell him that. I'm hoping I do so well that maybe you fire him and put me in his place. But I don't think it's
impossible.
Right,
but
it's gonna
happen. Nice idea.
No, it's not a nice idea. It's a terrible idea. I want John to be successful.
Well, John could not. He wouldn't have the gravity when talking about the situation.
Oh, he has gravity talking about anything.
That is kind of true, actually.
Yeah, he has
very
gravity.
Grave. He's a grave person.
He is grave.
He's not grave.
All right. The situation in Israel and the Gaza and the Palestinian territories is worse by the day.
That's grave.
Hamas is firing rockets into Israel from Gaza, including long-range rockets that can reach the northern populated cities. Israel has been launching airstrikes in Gaza, apparently killed some dozens of people, and maybe preparing for another ground invasion. The Israelis and the Palestinians both seem full of fear and hatred and anger, disappointment. Israelis about the horrifying kidnapping and murder of 3 Israeli teens a few weeks ago, and then the terror of Hamas's rocket attacks. Palestinians about the apparent retaliatory murder of a Palestinian teenager, the Israeli airstrikes, the settlement expansion, and the just continued immiseration of Palestinians. So, Jeff, you have been covering this issue with rare subtlety. Is there anything different in the dynamic between Israel and Palestinians over the past few weeks that the change, I mean, it's already been a kind of despairing situation. Is anything different that makes us should make us despair more?
More than the usual.
More than the usual,
despair.
Yeah.
Well, what should make us despair more than the usual despair is that the rest of the Middle East is even worse. And what's interesting about this week is that we've stopped talking completely about the Middle East. We just passed the 170,000 death mark in Syria. No one seems to care about that at the moment because this is going on. In the Israeli-Palestinian context, you know, hatred just gets more deeply embedded every time there's a death or a rocket or, you know, anytime your children get their house blown up or your children have to spend the night living in a bomb shelter. It just embeds this more deeply. It is proof, if nothing else, that Hamas is an illogical organization. And if nothing else, it proves that the status quo is not sustainable. But this is the third round of this Gaza-Israel war, and they have the same features. You know, it will end. And then it'll happen again. And that's maybe the most depressing part.
Right. There's this phrase, mowing the lawn.
Yeah.
Which is the idea that there's the shoot.
It's a cop phrase, actually. It's an American cop phrase.
So what
you know,
does it
which
mean?
You go into a neighborhood, you arrest the drug dealers, and, you know, and they come out, and you got to mow the lawn again, put them back in jail. It's the same thing in Gaza now. I think some Israeli general used it. It's basically, you know, you go in, you destroy as many rocket launchers as possible, and then you know that in a year from now, you're going to have to mow again. Different. This is one thing that's different is that now, as much as Israel hates Hamas, Egypt, which controls Gaza's southern border, hates Hamas even more. The government of Egypt is radically opposed to Hamas. And so Hamas is in a bad position anyway, because it's not going to have an easy time getting rockets in the same way that it was during the Morsi period or before that, during the period of chaos. So I'm sort of amazed that they're spending as many rockets as they are, which suggests either they're completely foolish or that they have more rockets than people thought.
I think of this as the hourglass where the sand is running out because of the shifting demographic picture, where there are going to be soon more or close to as many Palestinians and Arabs as Jewish Israelis, if you include the West Bank, in thinking about Greater Israel. And that seems to me that it's not exerting the intense, urgent pressure on Bibi Netanyahu's government as I always want it to. Is that because it's just not immediate enough, given all the violence and the hatred that takes precedence?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Gaza's a little bit of a separate piece of it, because
yes,
Gaza's not going to be absorbed into Israel. With any luck, it'll be part of an independent, standalone Palestinian state. It might be absorbed into Egypt in some sort of future scenario that we can't imagine.
Lucky Egypt.
Yeah, you know, nobody wants it. But on the general point, yeah, I mean, your point is interesting because it goes back to what I was just saying about the status quo being unsustainable. Part of the reason the status quo is unsustainable is that the demographics are slowly shifting. I mean, it's not as dramatic as next year or the year after, but, you know, there's this belief on the part of the right in Israel that you could just kind of maintain this and Israel will be fine and the Palestinians will get used to it. And it's just not. I don't think that's true. This doesn't feel very status quo-like. This feels pretty bad. It's the Middle East, so it could always be worse, obviously. But
that's the tourism motto, you know.
What? No, I would say, though, certainly for Iraq right now, you know, we're not Syria, and Syria are going to have "we're not Iraq" as a tourism motto. But yeah, I mean, I think you're onto something. And the frustrating part, I think, the frustrating part for me is that I'm convinced, based on personal experience and talking to him, that Netanyahu knows that this is an actual problem, that either pathway isn't good. You can't keep them, but you can't let them go, is sort of where he is. And my argument is that if you allow the West Bank and possibly Gaza to become independent, you might have a terrible security problem on your hands in future years. If you don't, you're definitely going to have a problem in future years. So it's a choice between two, you know, really unpalatable scenarios.
Right. So if Israel keeps the territories, mm-hmm, and allows, which it will never do, allows Palestinians to become citizens,
it
becomes it no longer is a Jewish state.
It no longer is the haven for the Jewish, the one Jewish state in the world, the haven for the Jewish people, et cetera.
If it keeps the territories and doesn't allow Palestinians to become citizens, it becomes an apartheid state.
Right. Or like a permanent Jim Crow or whatever you want, a limited autonomy or some, you know, nonsense that's not really sustainable in the international system.
And therefore, there's only one. Well, or there's a third solution, which I keep on saying, just because it feels to me like Israel – it doesn't seem to me that Israel is ever going to enfranchise Palestinians in Israel, at least in this – that one can see
in the next
25 years.
Absolutely.
Why does no one in Israel say, let's just expel everyone from this land?
Because it's wrong.
I know. It's not wrong to
expel all the Palestinians
people.
From the West Bank.
Let's just go through that.
There are millions of them.
A, it's morally impossible. B, it's physically impossible. Well, what's going to happen? I mean, the most likely scenario is that the Palestinians will be expelled with their land, which is to say this unilateral idea that, you know, you can't – if the Israeli view, and it's grounded in some reality, is that we're never going to actually – cut a political deal with the Palestinians, what we should at least do is get out of their hair, disentangle ourselves as much as possible. This is the tragedy of the settler movement. The settler movement is the vanguard of binationalism. It's not the vanguard of Zionism. It's the vanguard of, like, mixing everybody up instead of working toward a divorce. What you're aiming for is an amicable divorce where the Palestinians go that direction, Israelis go that direction, and everybody kind of just survives.
Right, but given that does seem to be the solution if you were designing.
And Netanyahu knows that that's the solution,
by
the way.
But then why is it? It doesn't seem that the settler movement is weaker. It seems that the settler movement is progressively stronger and a larger portion of the population.
Well, he gives into them because he has politics, just like everybody else has politics, and he wants to.
Well,
I mean, this is the problem. Yeah, this is the problem with his politics is that he's not, in my opinion, brave enough to tell the right wing, said, you're not helping here, and I'm going to risk my governing coalition to make that point. Although he knows that the polls show that the majority of Israelis agree with him about this assessment. So,
I mean, won't that be his failure as a leader forever?
And if he doesn't do it. I mean, if he doesn't.
So you haven't lost hope that he might get some courage?
I haven't lost all hope. No, I haven't lost all hope. But I think sometimes reality will actually force them to do the thing that he might not want to do.
What are the domestic political movements within Israel that set up countervailing forces to him? Is there a sort of center?
Well, no,
is there a center that can rule?
The problem is that there are not many credible center-left politicians. You know, the real tragedy of the moment is that Netanyahu was the only politician who could deliver 70 or 75% of Israelis to a peace deal, a compromise, precisely because they know he's a hardhead. The fact that he's a hardhead, of course, makes it very hard for him to actually go ahead and do this thing. The left will not make peace with the Palestinians because they won't have enough credibility in the Israeli center to do it. So it has to be a right-winger. It has to be... Look, it was going to be Ariel Sharon, but he had a stroke. Before that, it was going to be Yitzhak Rabin, who wasn't a right-winger, but he was certainly a hard-headed general.
Him.
Right. I mean, so, you know, the strokes and assassins can change the world, as we see. And so Netanyahu, it's really on him for the time being to try to figure out a way. But, you know, and by the way, let's just not absolve the Palestinian leadership of being weak-kneed and vacillating and not being able to sort of talk to their own people honestly about the situation. I mean, but that's been true throughout Palestinian history. From the 30s on, they haven't been able to say, oh, look, by the way, the Jews are here and that they are from here, and so they're going to have a country here too, so let's just deal with that reality. They haven't really come over that. On the other hand, the Palestinian leader, Abu Mazen, is probably the most moderate Palestinian leader we're ever going to see.
So you did this interesting interview with Martin Indyk. Maybe I'd ask
I was going to ask about that.
Well, but why don't you both ask?
No,
David don't started. He'll
well,
want
so you
to
did this
interesting
interview
question.
With Martin Indyk, and one, he said something which I just found to be incredible, like as in not believable, that we were this close to a deal.
We're always this close to a deal.
Yeah, so it's
everybody who's listening, hold your fingers like an inch apart, and then you'll see how close everybody always thinks a deal is. Yeah.
But he said that sort of the dynamic you're talking about, that Abu Mazen kind of got near a deal and.
Look, I don't believe.
Freaked out.
Yeah, and froze because Netanyahu wouldn't stop the settlements.
Yeah,
from
that's kind of nonsense, though. That's kind of like.
Oh, tell us why it's nonsense.
Because Abu Mazen and Arafat were negotiating for years when settlements were growing, and you have to remember that most of the settlement growth is in the blocks that the Palestinians already have said they're going to be attached to Israel in exchange for land swaps. They're a convenient excuse, and they certainly what settlement growth does is signal to average Palestinians, non-radical whatever Palestinians, that oh hey, the Israelis really aren't that interested in giving me a state. Abu Mazen knows exactly what's going on and could have jumped over this, leapfrogged this by saying, all right, you know, put your money where your mouth is. Let's actually see your proposals. But Abu Mazen, as of March, I guess, March or April of this year, basically never even responded to American proposals. I mean, literally, John Kerry would say, how about this? I've got Netanyahu to go to here. What do you say? And Abu Mazen literally said, I'll get back to you, and never got back to him. So it was not really
He gets a lot of email, probably.
Yeah, it must be.
Do you think that the U.S. has any role to play right now?
Yeah, and U.S. can keep things from getting worse. The same role it has in other parts of the Middle East. You know, try to ameliorate, try to you know, suspend.
Seems to be working in
Yeah. No, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it's interesting. You know, here's a situation in which the U.S. is Israel's closest ally for any number of reasons. The U.S. gives the Palestinians hundreds of millions of dollars a year, and it can't get either party to do what it wants. So then you hear people are saying, well, what we need to do is get more deeply involved in trying to get the Shia and Sunni in Iraq to get along. And you're like, really? You know, people who already hate us are going to listen to our prescriptions. So it's sort of like, on the other hand, yeah, I think when the U.S. withdraws from these problems, the problems tend to get worse. So having active diplomacy is pretty useful. And at a certain point, the U.S. is going to tell Israel, okay, that's enough of this round of the war. And they're going to get Turkey and Qatar to tell Hamas, okay, chill out with the rockets. And then we'll go back to the status quo for a while. And then this will happen again.
Jeff, do you have any sympathy for the boycott, divestments, and sanctions movement? The argument that I've been thinking about lately, which I'm confused by, is that most of the time when you have terrible behavior by a state, you have an authoritarian regime. And so if you boycott, you know, academics or companies, it's not necessarily going to make any difference. But Israel is a very vibrant democracy in which Netanyahu, whoever else is in charge, is responsive to public opinion. And so the argument for this movement, which I hesitate to make because the idea of boycotting anything in Israel is I'm kind of allergic to it. But the argument is that you put pressure on the voters, on the people who can influence public opinion, and that it could actually sway Israel in the direction toward feeling a more urgent sense.
How do you know Israelis don't feel an urgent
sense?
How do you know that?
I think some of them do, but I don't
think
it's controlling the outcome enough right now.
Yeah. I mean, maybe they're the ones who are realistic about the state of the Middle East, though, and we're not being realistic sitting 6,000 miles away. I mean, maybe they're the ones saying, you want me to give up territory now? And we've seen when we give up territory, it's filled by Al-Qaeda. No, thank you. But going to your point, I'm completely allergic to this because boycotts have traditionally been a weapon used against Jews, obviously, most notoriously in World War II, but going back, you know, obviously, centuries. So I'm allergic to it. I mean, there's a legitimate debate, you know, obviously in American foreign policy circles. What does Israel respond to? Does Israel respond better to incentives and a close embrace, like a hug, or does it respond to pressure? I had an interesting conversation once with Hillary Clinton about this, and Hillary says, and I think this is probably correct, that Israelis will take bold leaps if you're holding their hand. Like if you want to tell Israel to jump off a cliff, grab their hand, go with them. When you pressure Israel, the national tendency is to kind of go up Masada, you know, and say, thanks, but, you know, we understand our history better than you do, and this is not going to end well, and so we're just going to
get... That also involves jumping off a cliff, I will just...
They didn't jump.
See, here's the thing.
Jumping.
It's the Middle East. Everything ends with a cliff. Everything ends
right.
with a cliff.
I guess that's the problem.
Jeff, because we have you here, so we've had discussions on the show historically, and Emily and I have talked about it. And one reason we don't talk about Israel very much on the GabFest is that it gets so poisonous. It's so difficult. You're basically the only Jew because you appointed yourself rabbi.
I'm the only Jew?
You're the only Jew.
Wow.
You're the only American Jew who is able to kind of walk on both sides. Like, you're able to say things that are quite critical of Israel and Israeli policy, quite critical of American policy, where people don't sort of cut your head off.
Not literally.
But why is it it's not a discussion that most people want to get into because it becomes so poisonous and so
I've actually noticed that on Twitter
so
this
hard.
Week, by the way. I've noticed that people who generally comment about everything just stay completely away from this because it's just a swamp.
Right. So what's your advice?
I mean, my advice?
Like Peter Beinart, who I know, you know, everyone has problems with what Peter says, but Peter's like he's a smart, interesting person who like wades into this with arguments that you probably think are wrong and
Well, he's not
battered.
Pro boycott. He's pro boycott of settlements, which is different.
He just gets battered.
That's fair enough.
What is it? How can this discussion in America be done in such a way that Jews feel like they can talk about it without without it becoming
I think there's toxic. Actually more discussion in the – are you talking about in the Jewish community or outside
Jewish
the Jewish community?
Community?
There's more discussion now than there's ever been. I think J Street's rise has been a good thing. I don't agree with everything that they say, but it's created some legitimate space for that kind of conversation. You know, this is life or death. So it becomes emotionally fraught very easily. And the problem for people who are walking a certain line, which is the people who say, I love Israel, I wish its government weren't quite so stupid. The problem with those is that every time, and I see this happens to my own work, when I'm critical of something in the Israeli government, anti-Semites will literally adopt it and say, look, Jeff Goldberg says that Netanyahu X, Y, or Z. And so it
but
becomes,
you can't let that control you, right?
Well, I don't let it control me, but a lot, I understand why other people say, you know what? I don't want to go down this road. I just don't want to talk about this. And, you know, there's a kind of analytical smartness at a certain point where you say, I mean, I've been writing about the subject for a long time. It hasn't gotten any better because I'm writing or not writing. So I think a lot of people just say, why do I have to bother writing about this? I'm going to write about something, you know, easy like abortion or, you know, or
gay marriage.
That was a joke.
Gay marriage.
Yeah,
progress.
Was, yeah. No, I mean, why bother?
Maybe you should stop and everything would get better.
Maybe. Maybe I'll try that after this war.
Now we have a word from our sponsor, which this week is Stamps.com. You know the feeling you get when you can get things done with just a click of your mouse? It cannot get more convenient than that. And now you can get your mailing and shipping done without leaving your desk, thanks to Stamps.com. Stamps.com turns your PC or Mac into your own personal post office that never closes. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package using your own computer and printer. Then just hand your mail to the mail carrier or drop it in a mailbox, and you'll never have to go to the post office again. Right now, if you use our promo code GABFEST, you'll get a special offer, a no-risk trial, and a $110 bonus offer, which includes a digital scale that calculates exact postage for letters and packages, and up to $55 in free postage. For all the details of the special offer and to sign up today, go to stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in GABFEST. That's stamps.com. Enter GABFEST. In a story for the New York Times Upshot section this week, the always delightful David Leonhardt makes a tentative case that today's young people, millennials and those a bit younger, may not be the reliable Democratic voters that Democrats have been counting on. Leonhardt's basic claim is that voters are strongly shaped by the political and economic environment of their teen and young adult years, and that the weak economy and the fights about Obamacare and various other things, and the general sense that government can't get anything done, will push these youngsters away from the Democrats and presumably, therefore, towards the Republicans, that Obama essentially will be held responsible for the sluggish economic growth and the inequality of the past 15 years. We're not here to debate the question about whether it is reasonable to hold Obama responsible for these things, which it is not, but whether, in fact, this political swing will happen. So, Emily, we have been hearing...
You really narrowed the terms here.
Well,
like
no,
that.
Like, let's... Yeah, let's not... We're not talking about the substance. We're just talking about, like, is this a real phenomenon? Are the millennials going to be driven away from the Democratic Party because the economy is just in the toilet and has
so
been?
So I found this article really... this argument really implausible because there's so many other factors that are pushing the millennials toward the Democrats. There's the increasing number of Latinos who are going to be in the country who, unless things change, break like 70% Democratic, I think. There's the social issues that Democrats win on with this age group in particular, like gay marriage and legalizing marijuana. And also millennials poll high in a way that's heartwarming to me for broad-based government intervention, for the idea that you're supposed to fight inequality and other evils with social programs put in place by the government. And the Republican Party right now is so very much against all of the things I just named, but that one in particular. And I also feel like most people hold Obama somewhat responsible, but get that it was also factors beyond his control in the Bush administration and that the recession in a lot of ways preceded him and he was left to pick up the pieces. Isn't that something that we've absorbed as a country?
Let me speak on behalf of the country when I say yes.
Please.
And no.
Is this Israel you're speaking on behalf of?
No, I'm speaking on behalf of Palestine at this point. No, I thought David told us not to talk about whether it's true or not. So I'm trying to follow your arcane rules.
Yeah, he was really authoritarian.
Yeah, no, I know. He really was. I tend to, when I read this piece, and I love David, when I read this piece, I kind of wish that he didn't write it so tentatively. I mean, if you're going to go for a leap, go make the leap. And there were so many caveats in it that I thought he probably doesn't really believe this. I would have liked to seen more on this. I think Emily's exactly right. Unless the Republic, I mean, the real variable is whether the Republican Party changes, I think, not whether millennials blame Obama for stagnation. If the Republican Party no longer seems anti-immigrant, no longer seems opposed to gay marriage, no longer seems to pot legalization and all these other things that you mentioned, then there could be a pronounced shift. If the Senate goes Republican, and then we have the next years of a Congress in which both houses are controlled by Republicans, maybe that's ultimately good for the Democrats because people will blame them. People will blame the Republicans for whatever stagnation they see.
I have a different take than you guys, which is that the Republican Party clearly is not a credible alternative and they're not presenting any vision. The basic project of the conservative movement, and particularly parts of it in the last decade or so, has been to strongly discredit the idea of government being effective at anything at all. And they've got plenty of good evidence, and they've acted to make government less effective and to slow things down and grind gears. And it's a project that has made people, I think, much more skeptical about government generally. If you look at the polling, people are more skeptical that government can do things. They don't believe in government. That is a recipe for moving people away from the Democratic Party, all kinds of voters, including young voters, away from the Democratic Party because they look and they don't see a government that gets things done. Therefore, they are less engaged with the project of Democrats, which is generally to get government to do better things. That doesn't mean they become Republicans, but it does mean that they are less Democratic. And I think those are two different points. And to me, what's alarming is not – I don't see all these young voters going out and becoming Ted Cruz acolytes and getting all enthusiastic behind that. That's going to be a small minority. What I do see is a large, highly disaffected group of young people who will be facing poor economy, poor economic prospects, tons of debt, who will be vulnerable to some other form of sweeping populist movement, something which is not necessarily what either the Democrats or the Republicans are offering right now. And that's kind of scary.
If you get nihilistic about the government and its ability to change the social conditions you're talking about, then what have you got? I mean, this is where I think conservatives, I mean, they have a few of them have some decent ideas about this, right? But not the ones in power. And so if that happened and we had that kind of populism, David, I feel like it would be a more lefty version of it, which could be a good thing from my point of view.
It might be. I just feel like it's uncertain. I feel like one reason we're entering a very treacherous political time is that neither party seems to offer solutions.
I think what you're saying to David Leonhardt is expand the parameters of what you're writing about, because there might be something wholly new coming down the road that's not the usual bifurcation. I'm just sitting here trying to figure out what John Dickerson would say, and then I'm going to try to say it. But
John Dickerson would have like six polls.
He would cross his arms and look thoughtful and then have something very thoughtful to say.
Dickersonian poll point to make.
Dickersonian.
Which is that the polls,
that's a great
yes,
word.
That's a word. The polls about millennials show that they actually do think that the government can make social change, and they want to give the government authority.
Is that because they're just young and because young people are optimistic?
People, right. Isn't that right?
I think so.
Well, but you're arguing that they're going to immediately lose that as they age, and that's the end of them.
I'm sure relative to older people, the millennials believe government can make change more than our generation does. But relative to what our generation believed 20 years ago or what our parents' generation believed 40 years ago, I bet they're lower. I bet their millennial confidence in government is lower than Gen X's or the
oh, absolutely.
I don't think that's necessarily true. Can someone please, some dear listener who knows the answer to this question, because I know you're out there, write in and prove David and Jeff wrong?
What do you guys feel? How do you guys feel? This is a totally separate point, but we're all of the Gen X. We're all in our 40s. We had a really great run as Gen X from like 1992 until three years ago, people paid attention to us. They cared. We've now been surpassed. Like the millennials, they're a bigger generation. They're so Instagrammy, and
they are really
and they are Snapchatting. They're right now. They're all just Snapchatting our
Instagram
podcast,
and they're the new thing. Who cares about us?
But right. So how do you guys feel that now that we've
they
been,
still want us to pay for them?
Surpassed?
Though, that's the thing.
They have a lot of college loan issues. How do I feel bad? Who wants to get old and
I don't feel bad
and turned into chopped liver?
Well, first of all, chopped liver is delicious. Second of all, I mean,
I don't want to be eaten.
This is as inevitable as the tides or whatever else is inevitable. First of all, I don't think we're that irrelevant. Am I deluding myself? You're looking at me.
Yes, you're both David is deluded.
David is looking at me like I'm deluding myself.
Well, it's not like I do. You know, there's still whatever 50 million of us or something, and we'll sell Depends to them and Metamucil.
We have to keep
them,
working because otherwise the economy's really going to fall apart.
It is. Looking over here at intern Max, just smugly
he
doing.
He doesn't look smug.
He's smugly doing something.
No.
Well, he is ready to take over the world,
in some
or will be soon.
Obscene way.
He was taking a selfie.
Oh, he was taking an imaginary selfie.
Now they take imaginary selfies
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that's so cool.
Who knew?
Yeah.
Youth today.
So apparently, we should be a generation that is quite Republican because we grew up, we hit our prime in the Republican heyday in Reagan, Bush. Do you guys feel that we are part of a conservative generation? I feel like sort of
no.
Temperamentally, I think we are.
I think we live in particular ghettos.
Yeah, what would we know? We live on the coast.
I don't know if that's something you could ask us. Yeah, we live on just one coast.
Exactly.
But you don't. I feel like people of our cohort are, in fact, not conservative in how they vote in the worlds that we run in, but they're actually more prudish and are more.
How
kind of
are you wildly generalizing? Like, based on what?
He doesn't like Instagram.
Large statement.
Like, people
like
who
you
use
rode
Instagram.
The subway with some Gen Xers the other day. What are you talking about?
He's interviewed a taxi driver, and he's extrapolating.
He was a 43-year-old taxi driver.
You took a sample walking
wildly.
Through the airport at the yogurt stand.
I mean, I think we're parents, and so when you parenting obviously leads you to certain conservative conclusions about the way the world is organized, and it's a little bit mysterious and off-putting when your children come home with new inventions and new ways of communicating that you didn't hear about. But I mean, I don't think that makes us conservative.
All right,
it's a relief because at least they are still the new thing, and they're going to save you and be your tech support.
And the great satisfaction, by the way, comes knowing that eventually they'll be replaced. And then we'll be able to wipe those smug looks off their faces.
Well, the one data point I use is that I believe our cohort.
I shamed him into a data point.
Our cohort is the lowest drug using cohort. We used drugs way less than people who were before us and people who came after us.
We're reacting to the crack epidemic. You know, the last time I saw David Leonhardt was 3 days ago in a Whole Foods. How's that for a data point?
Yeah.
That's an awesome.
What was he doing?
He was shopping for.
Buying conservative
foods?
No,
he was buying lettuces, different exotic lettuces.
That is wholly unsurprising.
Holy. That was good.
Holy.
That was good.
I don't think.
Oh,
do you guys have anything else to say? We don't have anything to say.
I just can't wait to get to the Warren Harding conversation.
I'm just waiting for you to bring up more fake data points.
Oh my God! Is
she always rough on you? I listen to this, but
that's
I don't hear that
show.
Quite
that's
that edge.
Show.
I don't hear that edge. So Dickerson is the uniter, right? You're the divider, and
I'm the divider.
Dickerson is the uniter.
And Emily is the wisdom figure.
Oh wow!
No, I don't think so. Anyway,
all right. So you're going to get a chance right now. So we have a great new show on Slate Podcast and Slate Podcast Land, the Slate Podcast Empire, which is The Gist with Mike Pesca. Mike Pesca, you know from Hang Up and Listen, and he has this daily show where he's doing interviews with newsmakers, and then he has this thing called The Spiel where he is riffing on something that really interests him. And Mike is the world's best talker. He is unbelievably entertaining. He's really fun, and you should subscribe to The Gist. But just to entice you to subscribe to The Gist, we're going to air a brief segment from a recent show where he talked about, that famous Ernest Hemingway, the six words short story?
Baby Shoes. For sale,
baby shoes never worn. And so Mike just did an amazing exploration of that story and like dug into it. And it's really, really funny. So now listen for that.
So the Ritz-Carlton Hotel is inviting fans, well-heeled travelers, to submit six-word stories that they call six-word wows about staying in the Ritz-Carlton, and they'll be turned into ads. Here are some examples. Honeymoon, lost camera, priceless memories reimagined. Dinner till dawn, laughter, years regained. Dinner till dawn? Here's your 4:30 a.m. pork chop, sir. All right, I got one. Sat on bed, naked. How many others did too? don't think. And that is why they don't do 11-word essays. Anyway, this whole 6-word fiction, it's sometimes called flash fiction. I guess back when flash mobs were seen as cool and not as a new way to say wilding to scare Fox News viewers. Anyway, 6-word fiction stems from this story about Hemingway. Probably didn't happen. But Hemingway composed the world's shortest short story, and it was the following. For sale, baby shoes, never worn. Ah. Now let's for a second put aside the fact that the Ritz-Carlton is launching an ad campaign inspired by a terse tale of infant mortality. But there's this. Anyone who has ever had a baby has also had at least one pair, and possibly many pairs of baby shoes that were never worn. There's no tragedy involved, right? There's no story involved. Right now on eBay, I looked up baby shoes. For four-year-olds, there are 13,147 never worn pair on sale. So then I said, all right, well, what about specifically? Let's think about Hemingway, killed himself in Ketchum, Idaho. I went to Craigslist in Idaho. In Boise, never worn baby shoes, size 5. Tag still on. An original price, 42! Exclamation. It just isn't the sad tragedy that Hemingway imagined. For sale baby shoes only becomes a short story when we ponder it. And when I tell you this is a short story of great import, it's actually a remarkable feat of filling in the blanks of the meaning of a thing being almost entirely influenced by the context of the thing. Baby shoes never worn is a literary genre with a deep debt to a ubiquitous eBay offering. For sale. Pillow mint. Never licked. Ah.
So now we're going to inaugurate a segment where every week we're going to talk about Warren Harding. I truly think we have gone however many years on the show. I'm not sure anyone has ever said Warren Harding's name. Can you remember?
I need the Warren Harding primer to get through this conversation.
Warren Gamaliel Harding.
Great.
Can you please give
name.
Us a few basics about the man?
I feel about Warren Harding. So I had this.
Do you have feelings for Warren Harding?
There was this friend of ours, this Norwegian friend of ours, who in the mid-90s came to Washington. And he was a friend of a friend. He was living in Hanna's group house for a couple months. And he was here because he was researching his dissertation. And his dissertation was on the subject of U.S. relations, diplomatic relations with Greenland during the interwar period. And so whenever I think of, like, the what is irrelevance, I think of Stein's dissertation. And that's how I feel about Warren Harding. So Warren Harding died in office after a brief and scandalous presidency. But it wasn't scandalous for the reasons we're about to talk
about.
What
did he die from, by the way? Do you know?
I don't know.
I don't know what he died from.
Max, get on that. So we're going to find out how he died. But now comes news this week that as a senator and I guess as a governor, lieutenant governor, he carried on a scandalous affair, an affair with Carrie Phillips. And he exchanged a very racy correspondence with Ms. Phillips. He called his penis Jerry. That's about the major thing that I remember. Talked a lot about her thighs. And then when he became president or when he was elected president, the RNC and Harding himself paid her off when she blackmailed him. She threatened to go public with this, and he came up with a bunch of money. I think they sent her on a foreign tour.
Well, also, by the way, she was a German spy.
And she was definitely a German sympathizer. She was pro-Jerry. She was pro-Jerry.
She was pro-Jerry in
all respects.
So many ways.
That was a pretty good pun.
Comprehensively pro-Jerry.
Anyway, there was all this correspondence of his, and in the 60s, it was discovered that, you know, the people who knew, I guess, knew there was correspondence between him and his mistress, but the family donated it to the Library of Congress on the condition that it not be made public for 50 years, and 50 years have now passed. Did you guys note the funny reason why the family wouldn't make it public? They were feared publication would tarnish Harding's legacy. Like, it would have helped him. At least people would have known something about him.
No, it would not. That's
people
like
would know him for something other than...
No. I mean, I think the best you can say, Warren Harding, not Buchanan, was like the great, you know, I mean, not the worst president, maybe the second worst president, right?
You're going by the theory that, like, no press is bad press here. This is not... If you have a dignified president in your family, you don't want Jerry to be the last word in the... 100 years
right,
later.
Why is the story funny? Why is the story?
Because he wrote about pillowy breasts. I mean, it's automatically funny. Didn't he use the word pillowy?
I think it's all about
Jerry. Which is also
Jerry.
Just a really weird adjective for breasts.
Yeah, it's not hot, by the way. It's not a hot word, pillowy. Yeah. You know,
maybe they made pillows differently back in the day.
It's a comforting word.
Yeah, it's more comforting. It's like the comfort food.
I want to interrogate this question of why this is why is it funny? Because he's like.
Because look at a picture of the guy. Look at him. He was born with pants. I mean, you know, this guy does not look like a bubbling volcano of erotic passion. So it's
also
humorous.
It's so intimate, and it's from a long time ago, and the idea that someone 100 years ago in office would be writing these kinds of, because they're kind of, I mean, the writing is awful, but it's also sort of sweet and attempting to be sexy and completely failing. I think that's what makes,
and think it was
naming
sexy?
His name as Jerry was an act of genius.
Yeah.
Do you think that at the time that was like sexting, what he was writing? Was it as dirty?
I've asked myself that question. Is that as dirty as you could go in the teens?
That plain blue.
Maybe it was. I bet it wasn't, actually. But maybe it's as dirty as a lieutenant governor could go. Maybe they didn't know any other words for all the various.
Isn't D.H. Lawrence and Oscar Wilde, aren't they writing around this time? I mean, I would say that they are dirtier. Or they're certainly better at writing about sex.
I interviewed this porn star yesterday for this project I'm doing. She was awesome.
Called burying the lead.
And so she was talking about when she appears in period there are period porn movies, and she had just been in some period porn movie, and that's period.
We got it.
And she said, you know what, we have to make sure the dialogue is fits. So I'm about to use a profanity. She said, you can't scream fuck me baby if it's like supposed to be Victorian era.
Do you scream?
Ravish my pillowy breasts.
Well, so I actually didn't ask that follow-up question, but I did feel like, well, but there surely that whatever the equivalent of fuck me baby, Warren Harding
How do you know they didn't say that back in the day? You don't know.
Yeah, no, maybe they did.
Maybe they did. Maybe she's wrong. Maybe it was crazier than these letters. Maybe there'll be a second,
I don't think it
a
would
second
sound
tranche
right.
of letters 50 years from now that are just out of control.
No, I think that it's an anachronism. And the porn star is correct. She needed a different phrase.
I think fuck is a very, very old word, isn't it? It's an extremely old.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that people used it and deployed it as they do now.
That's true.
Do you guys think it's okay that they bought off the mistress? Was that okay?
That's the scandal.
But do you
that's that seems impeachable, actually. I mean, not to, you know, bring up analogies to the Monica situation, but it's not the affair that seems to be Well, first of all, the fact that she may or may not have been dallying with German intelligence during World War I seems pretty. I mean, that's a pretty good story if it's true. And the payoff is a mega scandal that would have brought down the presidency if he hadn't conveniently died. For reasons that we still don't know, do we? Yeah.
Isn't this very Kennedy-esque, in which we might argue that we're better off having been shielded from all this information as a country, even though, of course, it's titillating and newsworthy, and we would report the hell out of it now if we possibly could?
I kind of wish I was shielded from this conversation at this moment. I mean, I don't know. I think we're all journalists. Don't we all err on the side of everything should come out, and we should understand our leaders in their fullness, even if it's unpleasant?
Wait, I'm going to pause for a brief interruption,
oh, no.
Which is how did Warren Harding die? So,
wait, can we take guesses?
Yeah.
This is not the guy who died from, like, drinking a gallon of milk and eating cherries, right? Who was that? On July 4th, right? Wasn't there a president who died from eating too many cherries? No, there was definitely a president who died
We'll find that.
All right.
But this is not him. This is not he.
You really worked the interns hard,
In the bathtub.
You?
He died in the bathtub. That's
he
my name.
He died like the Tsarina. What was her name? The Empress Catherine. No, he didn't die that way. That would really be horrible. How did he die?
So he died. Okay, so the cause of death is almost certainly congestive heart failure. And apparently he had had a series of undiagnosed heart attacks in the months before. But the occasion of his death is the good part. Harding died abruptly in bed as his wife read to him a flattering article about himself.
Never have your wife read a flattering
died
article. He died somewhat happy. Not as happy as he would have been with Miss German Sympathizer.
Good point.
Are mistresses disabling these days?
Yes, if you're president, I think we've basically ruled out men with mistresses from the presidency, and we're just going to have to live without them.
Really?
So be it.
Yeah.
It doesn't bother me a whole lot.
Do you find that controversial?
Well, no, but there are certainly all these men with mistresses who remain in the House and Senate. That may be a different situation.
I think that's different. I mean,
I said the presidency.
Presidents are fly-specked in such a way, and, you know, we want our presidents to be. I think it just goes to this question of you don't want your president to. you don't want to think of your president as a liar, and obviously having an extramarital affair axiomatically makes you a liar of some sort.
Also, it's a big distraction, right? I mean, that's the biggest downside in some ways, is that then there's this question of embarrassment and all this attention going to this issue that has nothing to do with the good of the nation. I mean, that's what was so...
What if you had a mistress? I mean, it doesn't sound like Warren Harding had her as a mistress while he was president. Their affair seemed to have stopped before he was president. If you
mean,
it came out
during the presidency that you had a mistress?
Yeah, it came out. Theoretically, it came out that you had a mistress.
It ultimately depends on what the First Lady says, isn't it? I mean, isn't that the...
Or even that you had... Like, Newt Gingrich basically had mistresses. He ran for president.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't think that's what disqualified him from office. There were so many other reasons for him not to be elected. Who cared about that one?
Yeah, I mean, there John McCain... Wasn't there... Well, I guess there was never... Those were all couched in these very... Allegedly,
I think it's possible that you could have had, but then you would have to figure out a very savvy way of making penance. And yes, Jeff's right. Your wife would have to be totally on board for forgiving you very publicly.
Right. And this is what happens in marriages. And I forgive him. That's the only way to. We're assuming that
past,
we're assuming we're talking about a male president and a female first spouse.
We are assuming.
Not that I had really well-developed feelings about Warren Harding one way or the other, but this kind of makes me. More sympathetic to the man. Like he had, he was roiled emotionally, and he was a confused and complicated being, emotional, sexual being. And, you know, sometimes we tend to neuter these guys and feel like they don't have inner lives. And so there's something weirdly charming about this. Maybe it's the distance that we have from it and that we don't really care about Warren Harding one way or the other. But there's something, it's a reminder that these people are people.
Beautifully said.
Thank you.
That is exactly right.
Is that something Dickerson would have said?
It is very Dickerson.
I'm trying to channel. I really am.
Although he probably would have been more morally disapproving.
Oh, he would have folded his arms.
Well, no, actually, no, he believes in sin. He does believe in sin. He believes that people are sinners.
He believes in redemption.
I bet he finds these letters charming too. We can ask him next week.
All right, let's go to cocktail chatter when you're having a conversation with your penis.
What? Doesn't that
what
count?
What do you say, Jerry? I want to talk to you about. So, Emily,
other presidents? Do you think other presidents had names for the penises? Or this is the only one. That's the interesting.
What do you
question.
Think? Richard Nixon called his
Tricky Dick. Ta-da! Hey, hey, ho.
Well, this actually
I think Jerry Ford called his Tricky Dick.
I propose this as a story was what is the male nickname that for penises? Because there's like, you know, John Thomas and Dick, and now there's Jerry. If you go back again, if you go back to medieval England, are people saying, you know, my Richard the Lionhearted or something? I would like to know the answer.
I don't know the answer. I thought that was a rhetorical question.
No, not at all. It's a deep historical investigation, which Slate is about to launch.
Can't you put an intern on that?
That would be hostile work
environment. An army of interns, Jeff. That's a big priority.
Hostile work environment. So, Emily, what is your chatter?
I am making amends for my digs at the World Cup by offering up a soccer chatter, which I don't know. You can shoot it down, but I think it's a good idea, so I'm going to put it out there. So, even I know that a couple of important games got decided on penalty kicks this week, right? The Netherlands won one against Costa Rica, then they lost, right? And then
yes,
they
correct.
Lost yesterday against yes. Argentina. Okay, good. I got that part right. So penalty kicks just completely suck. I feel this deeply as a soccer mom, because if an important game gets decided by a penalty kick and your kid misses, it's yucky, awful.
Oh,
and I feel
God.
This way for the professionals, too. So here's my alternative, which is not my idea. It comes from my friend Caleb, who actually plays soccer. How about instead you have yet another overtime period in which you, in 5 or 3 minute intervals, take a player off the field? So you take – how many you start with? Like 11? First you have 10, then 9. You keep going until somebody scores.
I'm virtually certain this is not Caleb's idea, number one. I've heard this other places. It has its
That's
own set of
That's not a response
problems.
To the content of it.
It's like not a terrible idea. Hockey does something like it. But the problem that you get in overtime, these overtimes, is that the players are just done. They are gutted. If you look at the end of a overtime in a professional soccer game, those guys cannot play anymore, and it becomes horrible and ugly. The penalty kicks was a solution that they came up with because extending play beyond 120 minutes was causing injury, and the game became impossible.
So could you game this, though, if you knew ahead of time?
Penalty kicks are unbelievably exciting. It is unbelievably exciting.
But they feel so random, don't they?
I mean, it's not the same as someone scoring a goal in regulation, but the point is that you can't just force it to go on and on until some. It wouldn't be like real soccer anyway, because you'd end up like 3 against 3.
I think it could be fun to watch. And also, couldn't you prepare for the tiredness problem by keeping some people off the field?
You know, listening to this conversation is like watching soccer for me, by the way. Which to say, I don't understand what you're even talking about.
I am done with you people. I'm done. Trying to like soccer by attempting to ruin the game with her
ideas,
cockeyed theories,
with her crazy ideas,
and then you over here.
Well, I did try.
Why do you do your cocktail chatter? We'll see what.
I didn't understand that it was supposed to be light chat. I'm trying to learn. I should have called Dickerson to find out. No, so you told me to come do this. So I read everything on the internet over the last 4 days, and I found this really interesting essay by Michael Ignatieff in the New York Review of Books that I wanted to talk about the challenges to, you know, the inevitability of democratic change across the developing world. But then I actually was on Breitbart a couple hours ago and I found something that was so perfectly stupid that I wanted to talk
about.
Perfect.
That's
but
better.
Shouldn't I have a sports thing?
You get the Ignatieff credit.
That was clever the way I got the Ignatieff
credit.
You named
Ignatieff.
And the New York Review of Books, I read it. And No, but this is perfect because for some reason this week it just sums up everything stupid. It's a headline in Breitbart. It says, Muslim prayer rug found on Arizona border by independent American security contractors. And I thought, that is perfect. It's got everything. So I was reading it. I was hoping, by the way, that some, what is the expression? Independent American security contractor referred to it as a Benghazi rug, because then it would have been like orgasmically perfect. But this is a great story. I mean, I'm not going to read the whole story. You can go find it on the internet. But it just gets at everything. It gets it at everything crazy and stupid. And it gets at sort of the serious issues. The border is a hugely serious issue. Terrorism is a hugely serious issue. Balancing civil liberties and the desire to have security, hugely, huge, important issues.
Was the rug actually on the border? Like,
well,
physically?
I can, you know, the story, it's not, by the way, it's not the best written story in the world.
Oh, I'm so
and no,
sad.
But I want to, it's just fantastic. Wait, this
you
is
think the guy
wait,
put the,
wait,
board, the rug over the
that's
wire.
When, wait, this is the, yeah. This is the independent American security contractor talking. That's when I saw this thing laying around and I was like, what the hell is that? We walked over there and I didn't want to pull at it or not knowing what was on it. I don't know what that means. I poked a bit at it with a stick and noticed some of the Arabic writing and was just like, oh boy. I snapped a couple of photos and then went out on our patrol. That's really, you know what it is? It's little tiny Guatemalan Muslims being sent over the border to I don't know what the hell they're doing. But it's just like, it gets at every piece of paranoia that we've been talking about.
Well, they're using the children as agents now.
The ability of some people to take serious issues and turn them stupid is just unbelievable to me.
Take that, Warren Harding.
Yeah.
That was a great chatter, Jeff. That was much better than whatever you were going to say.
Oh, really?
Michael,
you don't want to hear
that was
like
a perfect chatter.
Blah, blah, blah. Okay.
So I couldn't think of a chatter because all I've been doing is interviewing porn stars, apparently. But,
you know,
you
by
already
the,
used
by the
up
way,
your chatter
was...
is what you meant to say.
I did.
So you were interviewing live in person?
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever met a porn star. Is it interesting?
She was delightful. Yeah. Absolutely delightful. Great spokesperson for her profession.
Really?
Really.
A credit to her people?
She was utterly appealing, smart, funny, self-aware.
Well, I look forward to reading or whatever
it'll
it is
be,
you're doing with her.
It'll be airing. It'll be part of a podcast.
So
my excuse for chatter is the news this week that Crumbs, the cupcake chain, closed, got me thinking about this artisanal food trends and just thinking back, you know, you had, like when we were in college, there was the original frozen yogurt craze, then that went out for a while, and then there was like fancy ice cream, and then frozen yogurt came back, then regular yogurt, there were regular yogurt stores, and now there's the kind of gelato craze. But in Los Angeles seems to be the ground zero for all of this. There is going to be melted cheese, like the
grilled cheese.
Grilled cheese, excuse
yeah,
me.
That's something that's coming.
Grilled cheese, it
yeah.
seems to be coming.
For dessert?
Two different.
All the other things were dessert.
That's true. Those were all desserts. But
you
like chopped salads and burgers, those are other trendoid things that are not dessert that have made it across the
but
country.
But what's the next? What's after grilled cheese?
There seems to be a lot of tea. I think tea may be coming.
Mm-hmm.
What else did I write down here? Well, there was the bread pudding one, but I just don't think that's going to make it.
That's what I was thinking of, that crazy store we saw in San Francisco.
But toast. Oh, I had an amazing toast.
Toast, definitely.
Amazing toast. $7 toast.
And also those stores that sell cereal, or is that over? Is this cereal?
That's over.
That happened?
That's not artisanal.
Toast? Oh, that's not artisanal?
Cereal's not artisanal.
Cereals can be artisanal.
That would be, that's a business.
Granola could
that's
be artisanal.
A business.
That's
good,
a business.
Good job. Okay, let's do the credits. The GabFest is produced by Mike Vuolo. Thank you, Mike. Mike is a pizza bagel. Do you know what that means?
Yes. He's from Mazza Pizza.
Do you know what it means.
Yes.
I wonder if our listeners know what that means. Is that like a phrase that people
know? I don't know what it means.
All right, we won't
think
say.
Think about it for 10 seconds.
Okay. You're not a pizza bagel, Emily. You're a bagel. Our intern is Max Tawney. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Andy Bowers, who I saw in L.A. this week and had two meals with. He has become a vegan. Did you guys know that? Bowers is now a vegan.
I didn't realize that was new.
Yeah. He basically eats only hummus, which that's pretty vegan. Our show page is slate.com/gabfest. It has lots of links to what we talked about today. Max is stirring conversation on our show page, on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/gabfest. He's also tweeting as promiscuously as Warren Harding at slategabfest is the Twitter account. You can email us your love letters to gabfest@slate.com. Do not send selfies, especially not if you're Warren Harding. You can subscribe to the GabFest on iTunes. Leave a comment and rating while you're there. If you like the show, subscribing, commenting, leaving a rating really helps us. So please do that. You can find it by searching for Slate Political GabFest in the iTunes store. For Emily Bazelon and Jeff Goldberg, I'm Jerry Plotz. Back with you next week.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets. I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.